I have my guest with me this afternoon. Guest is Paul Fellows. Paul is the chairman of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon.
Timing was perfect, wasn't it?
Couldn't have been better, could it?
I think most of us saw on the news last night that they've discovered a whole new solar system. Six planets they think they've found?
It's a whole slew of seven planets, I think.
Seven?
Orbiting around a little tiny, tiny red dwarf star called TRAPPIST-1. What an excellent name.
Yes. So we were just talking off air earlier on there. Is there any... It sounds interesting, and everybody gets all excited about the fact that they think they've found some planets where there might be life and so on, but there isn't a hope in hell that we'll ever actually get to those planets, is there, really, I guess?
Well, not with our current technology, as we were talking about earlier. Even if we hitched a ride on the New Horizons space probe, which, of course, is not going the right direction anyway, but it's the fastest probe ever launched, it would still take nearly a million years to cover that 40 light years to TRAPPIST-1. So we're not going to be going on a rocket anytime soon.
So what drives people, do you think, to get all excited about the fact they've found these planets or even to look for them in the first place?
Well, I think it's one of the big unanswered questions. Are we alone in the universe? And we're doing what we can to find answers to that. 30 years ago, nobody really knew, even if the solar system was unique in having planets around a star at all. Some of Sir Patrick Moore's books talked about theories that suggested that the planets were a freak accident pulled out of the sun by a passing star. Of course, we now know, actually, from the research and the Kepler Space Telescope results and so forth, that almost every star has a planet, or at least even a family of planets, as per the one that was announced last night. The exciting thing with TRAPPIST-1 is that they are Earth-sized planets, not giants that are made of gas like Jupiter or Saturn that really wouldn't have a solid surface on which life could evolve, or not life like we know it anyway.
There's that phrase, isn't it? Life, but not as we know it, Jim.
Not as we know it, Jim.
Yeah.
So these are rocky, Earth-like planets, and they're also at the right distance, the so-called habitable zone, which means that they're not too near the star and getting toasted by the heat, and they're not too far from it and getting frozen up. They're in the nice, warm, balmy intermediate zone, the temperate zone.
That so-called Goldilocks
area. The Goldilocks zone. Which, of course, the Earth is just at the right distance from the Sun. Venus is too close and gets too hot. And Mars is arguably too far away and gets too cold.
And it's fascinating when you look into some of the physics behind some of these things, and you may know the answer to this. I seem to recall reading somewhere that if the moon, for example, in our case, wasn't at the distance that it is from the Earth, you wouldn't have the seasons, you wouldn't have had the potential for life to exist on Earth either.
Yes, I'm not sure whether I'm fully on board with that theory, but it's certainly possible that the moon stabilizes the tilt of the Earth's axis, which makes the seasons of the Earth more predictable and more stable over long periods of time. And it also possibly stirs up the magnetic core of the Earth, which, shields up, Jim. You know, we would get blasted by the solar wind without our magnetic field, which is actually one of the things that's happened to Mars. It's lost its magnetic field millions and billions of years ago, and as a result, most of its atmosphere has been stripped away to space.
So that's an interesting topic as well, because they talk about people travelling to Mars in the not-so-distant future. Is that a realistic prospect? Because you talk about the shielding that we get from all the X-rays and all the other kinds of astronomic sort of rays that are out there. But once you get outside, was it the Van Allen belts, they call it? Once you get beyond that, then we're exposed to damaging... the gamma rays or something?
Yes, those are high energy particles, the gamma rays, cosmic rays, X-rays and so forth.
So is it feasible that we can actually travel there?
It's dangerous, and one of the big problems is actually that on the journey from Earth to Mars, you will get quite a high dose of radiation unless we can find some way of shielding the poor astronauts from it. But shielding is generally heavy, and the one thing you don't want on your space rocket is extra weight, because you'll never get it off the ground. So that's one of the big problems, actually, is how to launch enough shielding.
So you're the chairman of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Tell us about the Astronomical Association. Where and how often do you meet? What do you do when you get together and so
on? We're the local astronomy club, and we're very fortunate in being able to hold our meetings at the Institute of Astronomy, part of the university buildings on Maddingley Road. So we have a Friday speaker meeting once a month. On the third Friday of each month, we get somebody, an academic or a famous author, comes to talk on some subject. And the next one is on the 17th of March, when we've got author Dr. Nigel Henblest, who's written lots of very good books about space and astronomy, and he's coming along to talk about the secret life of space. I gave him a free choice, and I've got no idea what the topic really means. But we do that, and we also have the Cambridge Young Astronomers Programme for 7 to 11-year-old kids, and that's at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. It's actually this Saturday, so if you've got any budding astronomers aged 7 to 11, come along at 10 o'clock, find us there, and we'll be talking astronomy for about 2 hours with a break and a cup of tea and a biscuit, and there's a parents' creche, so we can park the naughty parents out of the way and keep the kids all to ourselves. And we do an older 11-plus group as well on a Monday night, so we seem to spend our lives at the Institute of Astronomy, actually. We also run the Wednesday night observing sessions in conjunction with the university people. So every Wednesday from October to the end of March, we're there. And if it's clear, there'll be a talk from one of the postdocs, and then the amateurs will be outside setting up a collection of small telescopes and connecting them to cameras and some enormous screens, so you don't all have to queue up all night. You can all see what's going on at once and then peel away in small groups to go and look through the big telescopes in the domes. And it's a fantastic thing. We get about 200 people turn up every week.
Wow. So just now, I mean, it's not a good day today, lots of cloud in the sky and so on, but on a clear night here in Cambridge, what could we see in the sky just at the moment?
Well, just at the moment, we've got Venus, the next planet in from the Earth, very, very bright indeed. Just after sunset, if you look up to the southwest, can't miss it. It is shockingly bright. It's almost at its brightest, much, much brighter than any other object, apart from the sun and the moon, obviously. And so if you find that, and then just look a little bit to the left, you'll see Mars. That's right next to it. Not as bright, but obviously that reddish, fainter reddish colour. Next week, they'll be joined by Mercury. Mercury's pretty difficult to observe because it's so close to the sun. It tends to not stick around for more than about 30 minutes after sunset, or rise 30 minutes before the sun at the crack of dawn, but I don't tend to get up then. But it just on the 6th of March, it's going to be well placed, and you'll have Venus and Mars and Mercury all in that westerly sky.
Now, I'm guessing that with Venus, because of how bright it is, you would be able to see that quite easily with the naked eye. But Mercury, presumably, you would need to have some sort of telescope to see that, would you?
You would see all three of them as star-like objects of varying brightness. And Mercury will probably be as bright as one of the brighter stars of, like, the constellation of Orion. It's actually quite bright. Nowhere near as bright as Venus. Venus is maybe 100 times brighter than that, and just shocking, as I said before. But if you know what you're looking at, now, if you had a telescope, you will reveal each of those as a disc or a crescent shape in the case of Mercury, because it's nearer the sun than we are, and we're looking sort of obliquely at it. And you'll see a small pink crescent, and that doesn't need a lot of magnification to achieve that, so a small telescope will do it.
So if anybody's listening now that is listening to what you have to say and are interested in either coming along to the club or perhaps even starting observing stars on their own, what would you recommend for them in terms of what to buy and how much to spend on a telescope?
Well, the first thing I recommend is come and join the club.
Right.
And that goes for the princely sum of £4 a year for the entire family, so I think we're the cheapest in the galaxy. But I have a recommendation as regards telescopes, which is if you want to buy a telescope, start with a 6-inch reflector, a Newtonian reflector on a turntable mount. You can get them for brand new for about £200, really not that expensive. If you want to go a little bit bigger, £300 will get you the step up to the 8-inch size telescope, but it's a bit heavier, And so it depends whether it's for an adult or a child, because the one that you can easily get outside and set up quickly is the one you're going to use. And so, you know, don't buy something that's too big and heavy. And really, don't really go for the complicated go-to telescopes. I have one of those. I'm the master of it now, eventually. But to start with, it was the master of me and very frustrating. So it takes a bit of learning, even though they promise to find the objects for you. They don't until you beat them into submission. But we have loan telescopes. We have 6-inch and 8-inch reflectors, and we have a half a dozen of these that you can join the club, and as soon as you're a member of the club, you can borrow one of these for a fiver for a couple of months and try it out and see if you like it.
Wow.
And that is a much better deal than spending 200 quid and buying one.
I should think there's a very long waiting list for that.
No, really? There isn't, actually. We're lucky enough to have quite a few of these telescopes. People quite often donate them to us when they've finished using them and upgraded or moved on. And so, we've got several.
And with those starter, if I can call them that, starter telescopes, what kind of detail would you be able to see? Would you, for example, be able to see the rings of Saturn?
Absolutely, yes. Even with the 6-inch reflector, if you point it at Saturn, you will see the disk of the planet and you'll see the rings around it, clear as anything. Absolutely astonishing. You'll see Jupiter as a disk with some cloud belts on it. You'll see up to 4 of Jupiter's moons orbiting around it. You'll even see some moons around Saturn, even with the smallest one. And quite a lot of the other planets will show as disks or crescents. And then the moon, obviously, you'll see all the detail of the craters. Where, if you were going to go for galaxy hunting, that's where you need a bigger telescope that's going to catch more light. Obviously, that takes quite a lot more. They're fairly faint objects and difficult to track down. But for the planets and the moon, the starter scopes are great.
Now, just I saw in the news that coming along next year, they'll be launching a new space telescope, because already we have the Hubble Space Telescope right now. But that's currently, the Hubble's not the only one out there as well. I know I saw, is it the Spitzer? Indeed,
Hubble is, it's been there a while, and it's the workhorse for optical astronomy. But the Spitzer Space Telescope is infrared. It looks at the infrared longer wavelength part of the spectrum. And that's great if you're trying to look at very distant objects, because their light, with the expansion of the universe, has been shifted into the infrared. It's also great because it penetrates through dirt and dust. So you can see deep into dust clouds with it and study what's going on inside them. And again, it was used as part of the TRAPPIST-1 program. They used the Spitzer Space Telescope for that, because they were looking at a very, very red, cool star and looking for the heat signatures coming off the planets around it. So infrared was very important.
And is that in orbit also around the Earth, or is that
yes.
moving?
Yes, as I say, the Spitzer is up there now, still operational, and doing some fantastic work. It's been perhaps less famous than Hubble, but it's done an awful lot of really good work.
So what do you think with this new one? It's the James Webb Space Telescope going up next year. What will that give us that either we don't get at the moment, or what will it replace?
Well, the James Webb is much, much bigger than Hubble. It has a segmented mirror that is probably going to gather about 10 or 20 times as much light as Hubble. So it will see in more detail, and it will see much fainter objects and further back into the history of the universe, to the really, really distant objects from the dawn of time. And it's also going to be very, very effective in the infrared part of the spectrum. They're going to park it a million miles away from Earth, whereas Hubble is just at 200 or 300 miles above the ground.
All right. And just to put that into perspective, is the moon about 250,000 miles
yes.
away? So it's much further out than the moon, then.
Be 4 times as far away as the moon, at a point in space called L2, which is a point of balance between the Earth and the sun's gravity. So they can park it there and it'll kind of just orbit around without wandering off. Now, by parking it there, they get it away from all the interference, particularly the heat interference from the Earth, from infrared radiation coming back. So they can keep it very cool, and it's got an elaborate five-layer star shield, sunshade, really, to keep the main telescope from warming up. Because if you're looking in the infrared, which is really heat radiation, you don't want your telescope to be hot, or all it'll be doing is seeing its own glow. So they're going to keep it really cold by parking it in this special orbit and putting a sunshade between it and the sun.
Okay. Final point then. Just was it last Monday, I think, you had a masterclass in Cambridge, and you've got another one coming up in just over a week's time, I think. A week on Monday. Is that right?
A week on Monday, on the 6th of March.
What is all that about then?
Well, this is a thing I've been doing partly to promote the Cambridge Astronomical Association, but in association with the Varsity Hotel. They've got a lovely roof garden above the top of the skyline of Cambridge, and we've been setting up telescopes on the roof there and doing observing and looking at Venus and Mars and the Orion Nebula and what have you when the clouds cooperate, which they didn't the other night. So I'm afraid people got to listen to me prattle on and show them slides of what they were missing.
But the whole idea is to get people who maybe haven't done it before and try it out? Is that
yes, it was surprising how quite a few of the guests that arrived had not heard of us and the Cambridge Astronomical Association, didn't know we existed, and are now going to come along and join us. So that's a tick in the box from my point of view, spreading the word on astronomy, really.
And if people want to come along to that, where are the details that they can find for that?
Details for the masterclass are all on the Varsity Hotel's website. I think you have to book in, and it's £49, and you get a glass of fizz and dinner, and then me.
Right. Well, a fascinating subject. Thanks very much, Paul, for coming in and talking to us about this. And let's hope that in the not-too-distant future we do find life somewhere else in the universe anyway.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, too. So there we go. That's Paul Fellows. Paul is the chairman of the Cambridge Astronomical Association, and we'll put up some details on our website about the way that you can contact them if you're interested in finding out a bit more about that.